This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, this week in the United States, there was more extraordinary news of Donald Trump, the instability in the United States around the coronavirus, the partisan nature of this election, the behavior of the president gives quite a surreal air to what I think many people believe is the most important election in modern times, if not ever. We're joined now to discuss the election, which is less than 3 months away, by Niall Stanage, who's the associate editor of The Hill newspaper in Washington and that newspaper's White House columnist. Niall, it's not really hyperbole to say, is it, that this may be the most important election in American history, certainly in modern times?
I think in modern times, that's a completely valid assertion to make, yes. Donald Trump, I mean, we have spoken on this podcast a number of times about all the ways in which Donald Trump defies the norms of political behavior for a president of either party, the way that he has tended to erode, for example, the independence of the judiciary from the political system, the language he uses about opponents, the language he uses about US allies, et cetera, on and on. Now, it could be the case that the American people effectively endorse that approach come November the 3rd. Mr. Trump, of course, is trailing in polls at the moment, but that does not necessarily mean that he is a dead cert to lose in November. And whether the American people re-elect him or elect Joe Biden, either of those results will say something very profound about the nature of the United States as a society right now.
Yes, and that's the troubling sort of uncertainty, isn't it? It's the kind of unknown unknown, if you like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there is almost certainly going to be a tightening in the polls. Right now, we have Joe Biden up by, you know, a fairly significant margin in polling averages, around about 7%. If that result were replicated, there would be no sense in which the Electoral College would, as it were, save Donald Trump as it did in 2016. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. But as we know, Mr. Trump eked out a win in some crucial swing states. A 7% margin would remove that as a possibility. But most people anticipate the margin to come down. You and I have spoken before, and we may do today, about Joe Biden's vulnerabilities as a candidate. And, you know, for all the many, many Trump controversies, yes, it is clear that the coronavirus crisis has hurt him more than anything else has. But he's still about 40, 41, 42% in the polls. That's not good for an incumbent president. It makes him the underdog, but it doesn't make him an absolute no-hoper just yet.
Yes, and one of his most potent weapons, the most potent weapon, I think it's fair to say, has been Twitter and his use of social media generally, Facebook, of course, as well. And this week, he fell foul of both Twitter and Facebook, who removed, on the grounds that it was inaccurate, a statement he made on television saying children are almost immune or immune to the coronavirus. They took it down on the basis that it was untrue. And that is a development, really, isn't it? Because he is the master of Twitter. There's no doubt about that, is there?
No, I mean, he's clearly made more use of Twitter than any other president, any other frontline politician in the world that I can think of. And he uses that to bypass the media, to talk directly to his supporters and to really get his message out there instantly. He also, I think it's important to note, Eamon, has used Twitter a lot to drive the news agenda, yes, be it redirecting the news media's attention or just tweeting something that is completely inflammatory to divert attention from other stories. In any event, the developments that you talk about are important. He did tweet and put on Facebook a video clip from a Fox News interview where he contended that children are, as he phrased it oddly, children are almost, and I would almost say definitely, but almost immune from this disease, meaning COVID-19. That's not true. And it was therefore taken down on the basis that it was spreading misinformation. So yes, there's a whole controversy about that.
And it also contradicted, he was contradicted by Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is now on the outs, and Dr. Deborah Birx, who had seemed a little bit more compliant to President Trump at the press briefings at times earlier in the year. She's also taken a hammering from the president. So effectively, he's making this up as he's going along in terms of responding to the pandemic. And it's evident from the press briefings, which most of which I've seen this week, that he's making it up as he's going along to no great effect. At one point, he said, it'll go away. Everything goes away, which, given the fact that over 1,000 people a day are dying from the coronavirus in the United States, really is quite shocking. He also said in a HBO interview that I saw, it is what it is, when the death toll was put to him. And the interviewer, a young journalist, said, what do you mean? It was quite extraordinary.
Yes, yes. I mean, the whole effort by President Trump to, I would say, downplay the coronavirus and to appear dismissive of it has been really pretty shocking by anyone's standards. And it has characterized his approach throughout this crisis, not just in recent times. In fact, you know, it has been widely reported that advisors to him have sought to change that. I mean, one of the reasons for bringing those briefings back, for example, was supposedly to show that he was concerned about this crisis, that he was on the ball with this crisis. That clearly hasn't worked because it's his impulse and his approach to say it is what it is, or to dismiss it, or to say that it will go away of its own accord. Right now, Eamon, as I speak with you, there are around about 160,000 Americans who have died from this disease. Yeah. We are closing in on 5 million cases. And I think this is really important, the United States has clearly not bent the curve or flattened the curve or got on top of this virus in the way that, you know, many, many other nations, particularly in Europe, but also elsewhere, have done.
Yes, in that HBO interview also, he produced some sheets of paper purporting to show that the United States was best in class in the world. And he said that. The interviewer, again, a young journalist, responded very sort of smartly. He was taken aback. Trump handed him the sheets of paper, and the journalist just, I mean, this was a man who appears to be deluded on the question of COVID.
Yes, and that exchange, I think, raised issues about about the whole climate of the White House, which is one in which Trump seeks good news, and the people who provide him good news appear to advance in that world, and the people who would try to temper that optimism or provide more realistic news seem to find themselves on the outs. You mentioned Deborah Birx, for example.
Yes.
Deborah Birx was described by the president as pathetic a few days ago in a tweet, and her purported crime for that was basically agreeing that the United States was in a bad situation as far as the coronavirus is concerned. And Dr. Birx was someone who had, I think, tried to be more accommodationist,
yes,
with Trump's approach than Anthony Fauci had done. And like many other people who I think justify their own involvement with this administration on the basis that maybe they can change things or they can maneuver around Trump, this idea of the adults in the room, as it's sometimes called, that I mean, this is not a statement of partisanship. It's just a fact that that has almost always failed, be it Deborah Birx, be it Rex Tillerson, be it Gary Cohen. There's a whole list of people who have sought to do that, and it hasn't worked.
Now, again, he has turned to raising questions about the possibility of an election. He suggested that the election could be delayed, and that was swiftly put to bed by Republicans and Democrats, saying no way. He then, and this is his most forceful point he's been making, a political point, questioned the authenticity of mail-in ballots, said repeatedly, has said now for two or three weeks, they are open to corruption. They are an invitation for corruption, for people who don't exist voting, and all of this kind of thing. This seems to me to be a strong card to play to an audience who aren't really paying attention. How valid, because post-in votes are going to be critical in this election because of the pandemic circumstances, perhaps. How valid is his criticism or the doubts he raises about mail-in voting?
Experts who've studied that issue have almost universally pushed back against his characterization of mail-in voting as more dangerous than in-person voting when it comes to fraudulent votes and things of that nature. People maybe have a overly lax view of what mail-in voting actually involves. While the regulations vary from state to state, there are generally a number of issues about signatures matching. You know, if you were voting Eamon, your signature in many states has to match a signature that they have for you on file. There are other ways of tracking votes and things of that nature. There's a whole bigger question here, which we won't get into now, maybe we'll get into in some other time, where there's a big debate about election security here in general, be it in-person voting or voting by mail. And the broad fact is that there isn't evidence of widespread fraudulent voting here. Now, there's a separate question. Go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, sorry to interrupt, because I just going to say the memory of Al Gore and George W. Bush and Florida and hanging chads, that memory is fresh, isn't it? It's fresh in our minds and must be in the minds of Americans as well, because this was an election that really did change the world.
Right, the 2000 election in Florida. Now, the 2000 election in Florida, well, the 2000 election nationwide, it's important there, I think, though, Eamon, to stress that controversy was because of a really weirdly designed ballot paper. There wasn't a suggestion of fraudulent voting in Florida in that instance. There was a suggestion that the ballot paper had been designed in a really odd way.
Yes.
So that, for example, you had residents of a county in which there is quite a high Jewish population voting for Pat Buchanan, a third party candidate with a history of being pretty shaky, to say the least, on Jewish and anti-Semitic issues. So that's clearly a big issue.
Now, he's unlikely to win that argument, but I when one watches American conversations about this, many people are alert to the possibility that the result won't come on November 3rd or in the early morning of November 4th, that there will be a delay, that there will be confusion, and that he will refuse to go. You might correct me if I'm wrong, but this talk is more than idle musings. People are seriously concerned that he might not go.
Yeah, there are concerns in that respect. It's a complicated issue. I mean, I think you're really right, and it's really worthwhile to bring up this notion that the result may not be known for some time. That would be very unusual in American elections, with occasional exceptions like the Bush-Gore election, which was truly exceptional. My recollection is about 500 votes in Florida ended up deciding that. But there is this, there are two separate questions. One is, if the result is in genuine doubt for a long time, does that then produce a scenario where Trump is firing up his supporters? He's saying that the election is illegitimate. He's making charges of voter fraud, well-founded or otherwise, and then you're in an unstable situation. There's a separate question about him outright refusing to go. That is something that is entertained, I think, on the left. It is difficult to see how even Trump could hold on if it is clear. I mean, if Joe Biden wins by a clear margin, for example, it's very difficult to see how Trump could hold on. The issue is more if the election result is in doubt for a long time, what the effect of that could be.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Yes, now I watched an interview on Newsnight last night with a former Republican Senator, Jeff Flake. He served Arizona from 2010, I think, until the last midterm election. He declared that he wasn't going to vote for Donald Trump. He also declared that that Trump was destroying the Republican Party, particularly, he said, with millennials and Generation X. And he wasn't grandstanding. He's someone I saw. He was in the hearings over the disputed Supreme Court nominee. But a Republican, it seemed, who was detaching himself and arguing from the party and arguing that the party is being damaged quite seriously by Donald Trump. I just wondered how representative he is and if those remarks about Generation X and the millennials has some resonance for you.
Yeah, he is representative of a certain strand within the Republican Party. I think we'll preface this by saying that Donald Trump's support from Republican voters remains very high. I mean, in mid-80s to 90%. Right. But there is a strand within the Republican Party, and Jeff Flake is a good example of it, that is worried about all the things that you have cited, doesn't think of Donald Trump as a conservative, doesn't think of Donald Trump as really having any political principles at all, believes that Donald Trump is a purely transactional figure who is in politics for his own aggrandizement and perhaps enrichment, and therefore has all these concerns. I do think that there is a legitimate point to be raised about the damage that Donald Trump is doing to the Republican Party in the minds of those younger voters that you talk about. This is one of the reasons why this election is going to be fascinating. I was talking earlier on about the fact that the polls may tighten and this may be a closer election than it looks right now. It's also possible that doesn't happen. If there were to be a really stinging rebuke delivered to Donald Trump and that rebuke took Republican senators down with it, for example,
yes,
then I think that would be a very big moment because it would suggest, albeit after 4 years of a Trump presidency, that the kind of politics in which he traffics doesn't actually work beyond that hardcore reactionary base.
Yeah, and can you just explain to me and to our listeners, of course, the mechanics of the elections that will take place alongside the presidential election, that is, the House of Representatives, as you explained it to me during the week when we had a conversation, they all have to stand for re-election every 2 years. In the Senate, it's somewhat different. You have a six-year term, and then you have to stand. And I think a third of the Senate is up for grabs or something like that. Can you explain to us how that works and how significant it is, assuming, for example, you had a Biden presidency?
Yeah, so just briefly, I mean, the House of Representatives has 435 members, all of whom serve just two-year terms. So every election, be it a presidential year or a so-called midterm year, all of the House are up for re-election. The Senate is a more peculiar system. It is a six-year term in the Senate, but the elections are held on a rolling basis. So every election year, every 2 years, one-third of the Senate is up for re-election. Right now, Democrats have the majority in the House of Representatives. They are not expected to lose that, certainly as it stands right now. That means that the expectation is Nancy Pelosi will continue to be Speaker of the House of Representatives. But the Senate, in terms of the Congress, is where the action is come yes. November. Republicans hold a fairly narrow majority in the Senate. That could be endangered. If it were, that would change a lot, assuming Joe Biden is elected. Because, again, to make a long story short, Senate votes are increasingly done on the basis of a simple majority rather than a supermajority, which had been required more in the past.
Right.
And if Democrats hold the majority there and the House and the White House, that's what's known here as a unified government, and it gives Joe Biden, were he to be elected, much more leeway to do whatever he wishes to do.
Yes. Now, the question of the Biden campaign, and he had said that he would announce his running mate for the vice presidency this week, actually. He hasn't done so. And I noted again from homework that you sent me, Niall, that an issue has arisen around one of the potential choices to run with Biden, Karen Bass. She's a Democrat member of the House of Representatives. She has problems in Florida because she supported Fidel Castro, and that is poison electorally in Florida. So she apparently otherwise... she would have been a credible candidate. What's happening there? Is there anybody emerging? And what's the story with Karen Bass and the need not to alienate Cuban Americans?
I think maybe the first part is the most interesting part to take right away. Cuban Americans in Florida are a vital constituency, making up around about 6% of the votes cast there. There's a whole fascinating history here. I mean, most Cuban Americans in Florida are fled Florida, whether during or in the immediate aftermath of Fidel Castro's revolution or in later waves. And typically are hostile to Castro, who, of course, died several years ago, and hostile to people who are sympathetic to him.
Yes.
Karen Bass pretty clearly was sympathetic to him. I mean, we could go into the history of that, but she made sort of rather, she paid tribute to him in his death in rather glowing terms.
She paid tribute to El Presidente.
El Comandante en Jefe, I believe, which is my Spanish pronunciation isn't the best, but basically Commander-in-Chief, which is not just a statement of fact, but a phrase that the Cuban government or regime used about Castro itself. The point is that may not have done Karen Bass any great harm in the left-wing circles in California, in which she has typically moved, but it's very dangerous in Florida because of the Cuban-American vote. So anyway, that has put Karen Bass's stock down a bit. Susan Rice, who your listeners may remember, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Obama presidency, is someone who I think has risen a little bit in the so-called Veep stakes. And of course, Kamala Harris, senator from California, continues to be one of the leading candidates there.
Now, one of the things that President Trump has sought this week that would be unusual is an extra debate. His argument is because there has been no conventional campaigning, and it looks like there isn't going to be even conventions, that an extra debate should be held early. And first of all, because the first organized debate is on September 28th, Trump has made the argument, and people have made the argument for him, because mail-in voting can start pretty soon if it hasn't even started. A lot of people, millions of people, will have voted before the first debate. So that's what he's looking for.
Yes, that's right. The early voting picture is itself fascinating. We keep talking about November the 3rd being election day, which of course it is, but many, many people can vote before then, millions of people. And that is what the Trump campaign is using as its rationale to seek this earlier debate than the three already scheduled. I think it's important to stress, Eamon, that whether that argument about early voting is considered valid or not, the Trump campaign is doing that because they think more debates could be to their advantage. They think that Joe Biden is pretty shaky, and indeed he did appear quite shaky in some debates during the Democratic primary. So therefore, the Trump campaign's belief is clearly, we are behind, we need to change that. One of the best big opportunities to change that is the debates. Therefore, the more debates, the better.
Now, the Biden campaign, and since we last spoke 7 days ago, now he did speak the week before this one. He made a speech and took questions. I saw it. It was, I don't know, not great, but not bad. It was somewhere in between. It was certainly not presidential. It was not energetic. It appeared a bit shaky. Has he left his home in Delaware this week? And is his campaign simply going to consist of giving well-designed, but rather not rather tame interviews, or and allow Trump to trip himself up and get in his own way?
I think that the effort or the intention is to do the second, quite frankly. I mean, Joe Biden has been propelled into the polling lead, not by anything that he has done, really, but by Donald Trump's propensity to mess himself up. So Biden has, for example, given TV interviews this week. He has said, you know, made public remarks in various ways. He has got himself into some difficulty with some of those remarks. In fact, just yesterday, he was apologizing for a clumsy remark that seemed to indicate or seemed to suggest that the Black community, the African-American community, was in some way monolithic. He was contrasting that or seeking to contrast that with the Latino community. I mean, I understand the point he was trying to make, which is, to circle back to something we were just talking about, the political views of, say, Cuban-Americans are often rather different to those of Mexican-Americans. But the suggestion or the way it came out in Biden's case was sort of Black people are all the same, which is a very tone-deaf way of putting it.
Yeah,
so I think that, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say he made another clumsy remark to a Black interviewer a couple of weeks ago, in which he said, "You can't be Black if you're not voting for me," which was, hello, you know. He should just get a generic apology, shouldn't he? And just post it. I'm sorry for everything.
Like a rubber stamp each time
you were going to make a point there, and I interrupted you.
Well, it's just that the Biden does have this tendency towards these rather tone-deaf remarks. And of course, now the spotlight is on him more intensely than ever before. I mean, it was a different thing when he was one of a number of Democratic candidates seeking the nomination. Now he's the guy, you know, he's going to officially accept the nomination a very short time, a matter of weeks from now. He's going to pick his vice presidential person. It's going to be him. And so that's why I think Democrats who have never been that inspired by Joe Biden are nervous. They're nervous about the debates. Yes. They're nervous about his general approach. Now, in saying all of that, you know, Twitter is not the real world, the full world. I mean, Joe Biden won the Democratic nomination because a lot of people who are not necessarily vocal voted for him. And obviously that's what they'll be hoping to replicate in November 3rd.
Just a final question, Niall, about the Democratic Party in general, the Clintons, the Obama, for example. I saw Axelrod, who was Obama's first chief of staff and who was a mentor to him, getting behind Biden. How, and of course, Bernie Sanders, AOC, and people like that, how united and determined are the Democrats behind the Biden candidacy?
I think they're united for now because the Biden candidacy is the way to get Donald Trump out of the White House. That is the glue that holds the Democratic Party together right now, much more strongly than anything else.
Yes.
If Joe Biden wins in November, then I do think you will see much more heated ideological battles between the left of the Democratic Party and the center left as to what he should actually do. But right now, the Democratic Party is is united because of its antipathy toward Trump. One thing, Eamon, just to point out there, though, is its capacity to demonstrate that unity in a very glitzy or powerful way has been essentially eliminated by the coronavirus, because now basically nothing is going to happen in Milwaukee, which was to have been the site of the Democratic convention. There were all sorts of back and forth as to what was going to happen exactly. But now neither Biden nor any of the frontline figures that you mentioned are going to travel to Milwaukee because of fears about the coronavirus. And that obviously is an issue.
Okay, now we're very grateful to you, as always, for joining us from Washington. And that's all we have time for. We're grateful to Niall, of course, to you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.